From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. A federal advisory panel is meeting at this hour to decide the fate of the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine. Distribution of the JJ vaccine was paused last week after reports of extremely rare but potentially deadly blood clots. And this all comes as the CDC says the rate of vaccinations in our country is slowing down. Dr. Lena Nguyen joins us now with the latest on Skype. She's an emergency room physician and a professor of public health at George Washington University. Dr. Nguyen, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to join you.
Yes. Yeah, so tell us more about this panel that's meeting today. It's the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Who's on this committee and what's the range of options for what they could decide to do?
Well, currently, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is put on pause. The CDC and the FDA had decided together that they wanted to use an abundance of caution. They wanted to use this time for a pause in order to see if there are more cases of this extremely rare blood clotting disorder that is perhaps associated with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The CDC Independent Advisory Committee actually met a week ago. They came up with no recommendations at that time. They said they wanted more information, and they are meeting again today. So this is a group of independent experts that advise the CDC. And I really hope that they will come up with some type of recommendation today. The continued pause just would not make sense. The initial pause made sense to find out more information, to look for new cases if there are, and also to examine the existing cases to look for a possible link. But I hope that they come to a recognition today that a pause and indecision is a decision too, and that there is real harm being done.
Well, doctor, let's talk a little bit about the concerns. In Texas, a woman was reportedly hospitalized this week with possible blood clots. She could be the seventh case in the U.S. associated with the J&J vaccine. Then there's Oregon, where authorities are investigating the death of a woman who developed a blood clot 2 weeks after she was immunized. These cases, as you've stated, are rare, but still really serious. What's your expectation of what the panel will do today?
Yeah, at the time of the pause, there were six cases out of about 7 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that had been given in the U.S., so very rare. But I also just want to state that this is not a run-of-the-mill blood clot we're talking about here. People often say, well, what's the big deal of a blood clot? People can get blood clots for a lot of things. This is a blood clot in the brain that's combined with low platelets. Both of these are extremely rare, and you combine them together, and it's really, really rare and very serious. So it is really important that this is very thoroughly investigated, and these two new cases, perhaps in Texas and Oregon, as we're hearing, should also be investigated as well. The European Medicines Agency, which is the regulatory authority in Europe, has decided that they will stop the pause on Johnson & Johnson there with a warning, meaning that the vaccine is going to be able to be given, but there's going to be a warning provided that there is this chance, this extremely rare, one in a million chance of having this very rare clotting disorder, but that it should still be available. And I would expect that this is the recommendation coming from this independent committee of the CDC today as well. They could, in theory, decide to continue the pause, but I don't think they're going to do that. I really hope that they don't.
You know, I have less than a minute with you, but I want to talk about something that you've been arguing, that the longer the pause goes on, the more potential harm it does, because it actually gives fuel to anti-vaxxers and misinformation specifically. Is it actually even possible to say how much damage this pause has done in terms of people going unvaccinated?
That's the concern, that there are people who could have received this vaccine in the time this pause took place who didn't get it and may never get it. Also, this is not just a problem affecting people here in the U.S. It also is a global problem, and we need to consider those implications too.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is a professor of public health at George Washington University. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's dig deeper into one of the week's biggest stories. President Biden's promise to slash U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in half by the end of the decade. The White House Summit on Climate Change is focusing today on how to meet that target because it will require a major overhaul of the economy. Nathan Holtman is director of the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland. His team has published a roadmap to reducing emissions by 50%. Nathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the big things it looks like you are calling for or suggesting is a look at the power grid, electricity. You're going to have to get half of it from renewables. And right now it's at about 20%. So how do you close that gap?
Yeah, well, the great news there is that we're partway there already. The renewables costs compared to even just a few years ago have dropped precipitously and in a way surprisingly. And what that means is that new renewable build out is actually in many places on par or even cheaper than new fossil build. So deploying clean energy is actually something that is a relatively straightforward proposition. There's a lot of support for it. People tend to like renewable and clean electricity, and there's a lot of benefits of reduced air pollution and improved health.
But what about those 200 coal plants that are still operating in the country? You say that most or all of them would have to go.
That's true. Coal plants turn out to be one of the more polluting sources that we have across all of the economy in the U.S. But at the same time, there's also a lot of really, frankly, aged coal plants. And the trends we've seen over the past few years, driven by the changes in technology costs for renewables, the kind of negative impacts from coal on air quality, and frankly, just other market forces have been driving coal out at an increasingly rapid pace, even in the past few years. It's also important to remember, we're also thinking about enhancements to the amount of electricity we need to consume to produce the same amount of service. And we've seen, again, trends in a very positive direction. Most people are familiar with LED lighting, for example, which has dropped dramatically in cost. And there's lots of other efficiency technologies that are likely to be deployed in this next decade.
Another important sector would be transportation. You say that 2/3 of new cars and SUVs would need to be electric. Describe the leap that would take, because as we know now, just about 2% of the cars on the road are powered by batteries.
Yeah, that's a great point. And basically, this is something that people might actually see more so than, frankly, our electricity grid, because by the end of the decade, something like, 60%, 65% of new vehicles will be electric. And that's, basically a pretty major change. But right now, when we look at EVs, or electric vehicles, we see that they're really on the cusp of becoming mainstream. There's a lot of demand for new EVs. And frankly, a lot of auto manufacturers have said they're getting out of gasoline internal combustion engines by 2030 or 2035.
And President Biden's trying to dedicate a bunch of money in his infrastructure plan to make that happen. But here's the problem I can foresee here. The average age of U.S. cars on the road is 11 years. They're very expensive. So you're going to have to convince people to get a new car and to get rid of their car that could last them for a lot longer. Otherwise, how do you approach that challenge?
Yeah, that's a good point. As we all know, we have a car, we drive it until we're ready to get rid of it, and then we just look for a new one or a used vehicle on the market. The same processes will be happening with EVs. And as you noted, there's some funding in the infrastructure packages and planning to kind of build out charging stations, but there's also other things that can happen driven by state and federal policies, such as tax incentives.
Other things you say would help the United States reach this goal are cut carbon in cement and chemical industries and in agriculture, but also things like planting trees.
Absolutely. And this is really important to remember. We're talking about, addressing the 50% goal. That has to happen not just in power and transport, but across all these different sectors. And then, on lands, there's actually plenty we can do. And if, one thing that's relatively straightforward that I think is quite understandable is expanding our forest area, planting trees. That's the kind of thing that actually does, in aggregate, help quite a lot and is going to be really important, not only for us to hit our 2030 goal, but also remembering that this is actually a waypoint in what we imagine will be a longer trajectory toward a net zero emissions economy by roughly 2050.
Given everything that we've just been talking about and the sort of changes it would require in fundamental industries here, how realistic do you think these new targets are from the Biden administration without major support from Congress?
These targets are certainly challenging and ambitious. It's going to take a concerted effort across all parts of the economy, all levels of government, and all parts of society to make it work. Congress will be an important part of that over the course of this decade, and certainly anything Congress can do in terms of new tax credits, incentives, investments as part of the overall reinvestment strategy will be quite helpful. That said, analyses that we've done and others have done have shown that there are multiple possibilities from the federal executive and from states, cities, and businesses across the country.
Nathan Holtman is director of the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland, explaining the way we might reach President Biden's goal of cutting emissions by half by the end of the decade. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Louisiana State University announced this week that it would not require students to get a coronavirus vaccine before returning to campus this fall. The reason? LSU officials say it's because the vaccines have only been approved for emergency use. Most universities in Florida won't require the shots either, nor will Dickinson State University student body population 1,300 in Dickinson, North Dakota. University President Steve Easton joins us now to explain why. President Easton, welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here, Peter. Thanks for having me.
And why?
Well, you already explained part of it, and I know other universities are making different decisions. All of these COVID decisions are a matter of balancing a whole bunch of factors. Health protection on one end of this is one of those factors. Trying to produce the best educational environment we can is another one of those factors. We are a public institution in southwestern North Dakota. Access is a big part of our mission, so we want to be available to as many as possible. And in balancing all of those factors, and then there's another one in the state of North Dakota. I don't know if it applies in other states. It's called the North Dakota Century Code. So our state set of statutes actually has some required vaccinations as part of the statutes, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, and some others, that our students do, in fact, have to prove that they've had those vaccinations. In that context, and when we're running a state institution with an access mission, it's awful hard for us to make an individual decision to add to that list of statutorily required vaccinations.
So let me make sure I understand. Are you saying that you couldn't really do it if you tried, but you could try? You just might run into some political pressure?
I wouldn't go so far as to say it's absolutely clear. My background training and career is in law. I could construct a really good argument that we couldn't do it. I could construct a competing argument that we could do it on an individual institution basis. I think as a legal matter, that's a debatable question.
I hear you. So why not do it? Because at one point last fall, you know this, North Dakota had the worst outbreak in the country of COVID. Its mortality rate was the highest in the world. And yes, I know numbers have gone down there. They've gone down around the country. But no reputable scientist is saying that this is over.
Your question contains part of the answer. The numbers have changed significantly. We have been at Dickinson State looking very hard at the numbers. In fact, in response to those numbers in late October and early November, Dickinson State went basically non-face-to-face from Thanksgiving to Christmas. We did not anticipate doing that at the beginning of the school year, but we saw our local hospital being overcrowded, and we made the decision to essentially, with a few exceptions, shut down our face-to-face instruction between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Now the numbers are much different. And frankly, people in our part of the world react a lot better to incentives than to mandates. We do have an incentive. We adopted a program approximately a month ago telling our students that they would be relieved the remainder of this school year from the mask requirement that we have on our campus if they received the vaccine and then waited the 14 days that the CDC has said you need after being fully vaccinated. And I want to make it clear that we are very pro-vaccine. Mm-hmm. We are trying to encourage our students, our faculty and staff to get the vaccine.
You've gotten yours?
I have, and I tried to do it very publicly, and we're very pro-vaccine. We're just reluctant to take the step of requiring a vaccine. A vaccine is an invasive medical procedure. We think it's a little bit different and a step beyond requiring mask use. And at this point, we're not comfortable taking that step.
You know what? I appreciate you saying that. I mean, it's true. That's the reality that you're living in there in North Dakota. And that's really something that would influence your decisions. On the other hand, if you are weighing what decision to make, isn't it true that no one would die as a result of this decision to require vaccines or to continue requiring masks, but someone very well might if you don't?
Well, you know, I don't know that we can say that. And again, I want to preface my next comment by saying that I think the balance is very much in favor of getting vaccines. I think we should do it. I think that's a reasonable decision. But medical procedures, including vaccinations, contain risks. And, you know, we've been quite criticized for encouraging vaccines. I disagree with that. All the scientific evidence, I believe, establishes that not getting the vaccine is a bigger risk than getting the vaccine.
You know what's interesting about this? Yesterday, we spoke with an executive at Northeastern University in Boston. They are doing just the opposite. They're requiring vaccines before students come back in the fall. And we're going to have some data that tells us whether this decision was wise, whether this decision to require vaccines was wise, because later this year, we'll see how those schools and campuses are doing. Are you open to changing your mind if the data, the science comes and backs it up?
Absolutely, Peter. We are monitoring the data. And I also want to be clear that I would not criticize Northeastern for its decision either. They're doing the best job of making what they think is the best decision. Reasonable minds can differ on some of these issues. And it would not be the first time that as a result of those statistics, we have changed our minds and changed our policy if we end up doing that.
Steve Easton is the president of Dickinson State University in Dickinson, North Dakota. Thank you very much for answering our questions. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter, for having me. Very interesting discussion, and we appreciate being part of it.
Well, last year, when schools in New Hampshire shut down, most people thought it would be for 3 weeks or so. Well, now many schools are reopening fully. New Hampshire Public Radio's Sarah Gibson visited one school where teachers and students have been spending a lot of the pandemic learning outdoors, and many of them hope to keep it that way.
If you walk past the Deerfield Community School into the woods, you come across a scene a bit like a fairy tale.
Hello!
The public school sits on 30 acres of woods with a pond. First graders are sitting near the shore on tree stumps in dappled sunlight working on math assignments. Marilyn Reardon says this is the best kind of classroom.
I like nature, so I like being outside.
When it's chilly, Marilyn and her fellow first graders tend to a fire in the fire pit.
You get some wood, put it in the fire, and it feels warm.
Seven more outdoor classrooms are scattered through the woods. Community members built them last summer for the pandemic with tens of thousands of dollars in donated labor and supplies. Across the stream, teacher Sue Laskowski shows me the outdoor version of her fourth grade classroom.
We can do everything that we do in the classroom out here. So we have a shelter, which is, you know, a heavy-duty tarp. We have a fire pit, so like a meeting area. We bring a whiteboard out so we can do lessons out there.
On warm days, they can do nearly all their lessons outside. In the winter, some classes still came out a few hours a day. Laskowski says students are thriving, particularly those who struggle in traditional classrooms.
All the things that maybe bring them down, you know, whether it's, you know, that they're not up to a level academically. But when they're outside, those kids are like the most helpful kids. They're the hardest working kids. And all of a sudden, everybody's on kind of like an equal footing, which is nice.
This social benefit of outdoor classrooms is Deerfield's big takeaway from the pandemic. Laskowski says most students are just as focused and less anxious learning math among hemlock trees than they are indoors. And during COVID, being so spread out has helped students like fourth grader Matthew Fowler feel safer.
Each classroom is far away from others, And plus, after you're learning, you can probably have some recess here.
Recess to build forts, draw on birch bark, or clear the leaves from the fire pit. And according to budding scientist Hudson Ronayne, age 10, the woods are benefiting too. Hudson says when he breathes out, he's giving the trees his carbon dioxide.
So what happens is when the trees get the CO2, they take the carbon off of the O2, they release the O2, and attach this carbon that's left over to their skin so that they can become bigger.
These students just started coming to school 5 days a week after being in a hybrid model where they rotated in small groups between in-person and virtual school. For Laskowski's fourth grade, this means there are now 17, not 9 kids in class every day. Laskowski says at first it was a shock, but then they went outside.
Literally, as soon as we walked out to the outdoor classroom, spread out, everybody, it was almost like they just kind of like heaved a sigh of relief. They're like, this is better.
And relief is a thing everyone here could use after a year of stress and unknowns. The school says it hopes to keep using the outdoor classrooms for years to come. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Gibson in Deerfield, New Hampshire.
I'm Yoe Shaw.
I'm Kia Miakonatis.
We're the hosts of the NPR podcast, Invisibilia.
You can think of Invisibilia kind of like a sonic blacklight.
When you switch us on, you will hear surprising and intimate stories.
Stories that help you notice things in your world that maybe you didn't see before.
Listen to the Invisibilia podcast from NPR.
It's hard to believe that the COVID crisis in India could get any worse, but every day that's what's happening. More than a dozen people died today in a fire that ripped through a hospital's coronavirus ward in the western part of the country. India continues to set global records for the number of new infections it's recording each day. The latest figure is more than 332,000. The BBC's Davina Gupta joins us now with the latest. And Davina, this fire sounds terrible. What happened?
It's such an unfortunate incident that's happened, Tanya, because there were 90 patients reportedly in the hospital when the fire broke out after a blast in the air conditioning unit in that hospital. And before anybody could realize, it just spread like a wildfire. And there were COVID-19 patients who were admitted in that particular hospital. And I've seen the visuals. It's just so heart-wrenching because you see a smoke-filled intensive care unit and everybody's running helter-skelter. The ceiling is falling off in some places. There are beds and furniture that are strewn around. And obviously, those who have lost their loved ones are helpless at this moment.
Oh. This is exacerbated by the fact that hospitals, they are overwhelmed. Hospitals are taking to their social media accounts, we're seeing, begging for oxygen tanks. They don't have enough for their COVID patients. Can the government do anything to deal with this?
It's a damage control mode in which we see policymakers at the moment. For oxygen supply, at least 8 major hospitals have rushed to government for help. And what has been done is a green corridor is established around the city. So there are trucks and there are oxygen tankers that are being deployed to get oxygen from neighboring states to Delhi. There's also security cordon with these tanks, because at some places, looting of oxygen cylinders have been reported. What we are witnessing, I have never seen something like this in my entire career. I've spoken to hospitals and I've spoken to doctors in hospitals where oxygen supply is left only for about 2 to 6 hours. Those doctors are helpless. Oh. Some of them are giving manual ventilators to patients. And my own mother, Tanya, works in a hospital as a senior administrator. And I can share this. It's so close to home that I'm scared every time she steps out because she has to be in hospital to manage the situation. She's a senior citizen. And for me also, it becomes really difficult to wait for her every day at home. And though we observe all COVID protocols of washing hands, sanitizing, but that scare doesn't leave you. And that's something that it's difficult to hard to live with.
Add on to all of this, we heard earlier this week about the virus variants that are raging across India. Mm-hmm. Are vaccines making any difference in India right now on this effort to fight the coronavirus?
By the time this wave hit, hardly 1% of the population, which was eligible for vaccine, had been inoculated. Right now, the government has allowed vaccine to be given to 18 years plus from May 1st. Now, we're seeing that families with younger children, and this could age between 8 to about 15 years, who've been reported sick. And earlier, we saw only the age group of, say, about 50 years plus that got into serious cases, but now even children are being impacted. And that's another, because you don't have enough infrastructure for children, and they also need their mothers or fathers to be with them. It's quite scary at the moment, I can tell you that.
Oh, Davina, thank you so much for sharing this with us and giving us the latest updates there in India. Please take care of yourself.
Thank you, Tanya. Take care.
That's the BBC's Davina Gupta in Delhi. One of sketch comedy's boldest acts is back. The Emmy-nominated A Black Lady Sketch Show returns to HBO today for its second season after a year when movies were forced to debut on the small screen. And the Oscars are this Sunday and will feature its most diverse nominees yet. Let's bring in NPR TV critic Eric Deggans for more. And Eric, I actually remember there was a lot of acclaim for the first season of A Black Lady Sketch Show. This second season was delayed by the pandemic. Was it worth the wait?
Well, they're always interesting. I love the performers that are lined up for this show. Robin Thede is sort of the ringleader and creator of it. And you may remember her. She worked on The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore and had her own show on BET. And she's got this great cast of folks helping her out. I didn't like it quite as much as I liked the first season. Mm. There's one joke in particular that is sort of this long-running gag that started in the first season where it's all these black women who realize that they're in the middle of an apocalypse together. Like, they thought they were at a house party together. And while they're hanging out together, like, the whole world falls apart. And they never really explain, like, what exactly happened or why they survived. But that joke extends into the second season and gets a little weirder. It doesn't quite work as much for me. Mm. So for me, some of the sketches didn't quite hit the mark. Like, there's one sketch that they do about how unusual it is to have a courtroom filled with black women. The judge, the prosecutor, the defending attorney, all the jury, everybody's black. And the Issa Rae from Insecure makes a guest appearance as a defendant, and we have a little clip from it. Let's check it out.
Ms. Judge, ma'am, I would like to say something. Ever since I first stepped in your courtroom, my life changed. I had never seen so many professional black women in one place. It inspired me, and I wanted that feeling every day. So I went from a successful but lonely small business owner to committing petty crimes and swindles, hoping that it would one day lead me back into a courtroom full of beautiful black goddesses.
You did all of that just to be with us?
Yeah, bailiff, I did.
Eric, I gotta say, that sounds kind of funny. It's dark and ridiculous, but it sounds funny.
Yeah, and they have a whole, you know, song that they sing, you know, that's also entertaining. Certainly, I appreciate what the show is trying to do, which is give performers who normally are at the margins of show business a chance to take center stage and tell their own stories. And so it's just a window into a different way of looking at comedy. So I enjoy the fact that it exists, even though I didn't necessarily enjoy the season's episodes as much as I did the first.
Point taken. Okay, I also want to ask you about the Oscars. This ceremony really hasn't gotten the TV ratings that it used to get back in the day over the last few years. But I'm wondering, with so many people at home last year and watching movies, maybe they're really into it. You think there'll be more viewers this year?
That would be the logical thinking, right? But you look at the ratings for other award ceremonies like the Grammys and the Golden Globes this year, and both of them saw fall-offs in viewership that were at least 50%, if not worse. We're in the middle of a very weird award season. The Oscars ceremony got delayed because of COVID, of course. Normally it takes place in February. Now we're seeing it in April. During that year of the pandemic, a lot of theaters were closed and a lot of blockbuster films and higher profile projects either got delayed, got moved to streaming, got disrupted in other ways. And so the field of films that we have now, I think, I'm not sure how many people have seen them. Even though they're available through streaming in various ways, I don't know how many people have seen them, and I don't know how many people will find them compelling. The most nominated film, Mank, is about a guy who helped write Citizen Kane with Orson Welles. It's very much a Hollywood story. You know, it may not appeal to some people, and even critics have criticized the pace of the movie. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here. They've tried really hard to tell people that this is not going to be like some sort of gussied up Zoom meeting. You know, they've established a lot of testing and quarantining so that people can actually be on site at both the Dolby Theater and Union Station in Los Angeles. And they also have people appearing by satellite who are not in the country and maybe couldn't get in because of COVID. And they say they're going to try to produce something that looks more like a movie than past Oscar ceremonies. I have no idea what that means, but Steven Soderbergh, the renowned director, is one of the executive producers. So you can expect to see some unexpected and inventive things, and no host once again this year. So should be very interesting.
No host, but this new format sounds like folks who watch it for the fashion will finally be able to actually see the fashion, not through a Zoom box.
Yeah, they are going to have a small little red carpet. So yeah, you're right about that.
Okay, one other thing. You know, the irony is that even as Hollywood has gotten more dependent on streaming, the Oscars itself isn't really that easy to watch if you don't have traditional TV, if you don't have, say, ABC. Where can people see it apart from ABC?
You can see it on ABC.com, and the ABC has an app, but you have to have cable service through a recognized provider, and some big cable services are not, don't have agreements with ABC. But it's also available on Hulu's live TV service, and it's available on YouTube TV. So there are a couple of streaming options for people.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This long-running host of Reading Rainbow, star of the miniseries Roots, and engineer Geordi LaForge on Star Trek, is now Jeopardy's newest guest host. Who is LeVar Burton? Yes, the beloved actor LeVar Burton is getting his shot at Jeopardy. The long-running game show has featured a slate of celebrity guest hosts since Alex Trebek died last year of pancreatic cancer. Trebek hosted for 37 seasons. Katie Couric, Dr. Oz, and Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers have all made a guest host appearance since his death. Each has brought their own style to the role. Here's Aaron Rodgers.
Title for 400. In the 1960s, these Midwesterners earned 5 NFL championship trophies. Green Bay Packers? Dennis, go
try
again,
title
I guess.
For 600.
LeVar Burton has made it no secret over the years that he's wanted the job. He's been talking about it on social media. But he got the gig thanks to a petition started by one of his fans last November.
I think it was a couple days after Alex Trebek's passing. I just went for it and started the petition, just on a whim.
Joshua Sanders is a researcher at the University of Colorado and a longtime fan of Jeopardy.
When they first released the original schedule of guest hosts, I was a little disappointed. I didn't see LeVar on there, and I didn't think anything of it until he retweeted the petition.
The petition now has almost 250,000 signatures. And after Burton was added to the lineup of hosts, he told his fans on Twitter, "You made a difference."
It's just been really interesting watching it unfold. I don't know, this thing that I did that I didn't even put a lot of effort into, but I do believe, you know, that he is the best person for the job. I think that should be obvious to everyone.
Burton hosted the children's program Reading Rainbow from 1983 to 2009. He encouraged kids to read with celebrities. Here's a clip from 1988.
It's one of the best things about being at a diner is the people. You never know who's going to drop by. In fact, who drops by is what causes all the trouble in this book. The robbery at the Diamond Dog Diner.
The series made a difference for Joshua Sanders.
LeVar Burton probably encouraged kids in the 80s and 90s to learn how to read as much as their own parents did, maybe more.
LeVar Burton inspired a generation, including me, on that show. Now he'll have the chance to inspire another on Jeopardy. His episodes are scheduled to air at the end of July. And we're glad you're listening along with us today on your public radio station. You can always keep the conversation going, you know. We actually do read our emails. Write to letters@hereandnow.org. I just responded to somebody today. We're also on Twitter. Tanya is at Tanya Mosley. You can ping Robin Young at Here and Now Robin. I'm at O'Dowd Peter. Drop us a note. We've mostly got thick skin. We would love to hear from you. And while you're at it, tell us your dream Jeopardy question. Here's mine. What is Here and Now? A new wave of state laws are targeting protesters. Florida and Oklahoma now have new laws to criminalize certain protest tactics. They also offer immunity for some drivers who injure protesters with their car. Lawmakers are considering similar proposals in many more states. Let's talk about it with civil rights lawyer Nora Benavides. She's the director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at the nonprofit PEN America. Nora, welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
And the last time we spoke back in November, a lot of these bills hadn't yet come up for a vote. Many hadn't even been presented. At the time, you were calling this trend troubling. How would you describe it now?
I would say it is still troubling, with the added caveat that it's gotten worse. And that, you know, since we spoke several months ago, there have been, I would say about 75 new anti-protest proposals that have been introduced around the country. But now we're seeing much farther reaching types of penalties for people. If you're convicted of protesting, you may be ineligible for public benefits in some states. You may be ineligible for state office or running for public office. You may, in fact, have a referral for your child protective services agency if you bring your child to a protest. That bill died in Michigan, but so many others are passing quickly, and the provisions are just very chilling.
What are the range of things these lawmakers are trying to outlaw?
Many of these are very clearly in response to Black Lives Matter tactics and, you know, the very large sustained demonstrations we've seen over the last many months after George Floyd's murder. So many of these continue to increase penalties for people who, you know, get into the street, who obstruct traffic. So in Oklahoma, if you obstruct traffic, it's now at least a $5,000 fine instead of what a low-level misdemeanor would have been otherwise.
And why don't we just take a closer look at Oklahoma for just a second and this new law that protects drivers, gives them immunity if they're fleeing a protest or a riot and unintentionally hit or injure one of those protesters with their cars. What's the motivation behind a law like that? Because we know people do get hit with cars quite often at protests.
You know, there's no smoking gun that every legislator who introduces these proposals around the country has explicitly said it's always in response to Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests. But the playbook is the same that we've been seeing since 2017. When progressive racial justice protests happen, whether they are, you know, the Dakota Pipeline protests or Black Lives Matter, legislators are very quick to introduce anti-protest policies that explicitly take on those types of tactics.
In Florida, Governor DeSantis is being sued by a nonprofit for the state's new law, which he signed on Monday. He said it's intended to crack down on the disorder and rioting. Those are his words that happened throughout the summer of 2020. Let's listen to that.
And we wanted to make sure that we were able to protect the people of our great state, people's businesses and property against any type of mob activity or violent assemblies.
That law in Florida would also punish cities or towns that try to, quote unquote, defund the police. It also would add penalties for trying to take down monuments, and that includes Confederate monuments. But it also makes it easier, as we've been talking about, to charge protesters with felonies. And I was hoping you could talk about that for a moment. To escalate this to the range of felony for somebody who is convicted, what's the consequence of that for people convicted of a felony?
I think that this is going to have a chilling effect on people and that people will think twice about exercising their First Amendment rights. And I think that those that do think twice will have to weigh a whole lot of things now. I'm really glad you mentioned the Florida bill because it is so particularly egregious, which I just want to be clear. What could happen is that one could face prison sentences of up to 15 years. So if you're thinking about attending something and you know that you may be ineligible for public benefits if you get arrested and convicted, you may be put in prison for over a decade, and drivers would be immune if they hit you and kill you, I think people aren't going to be protesting. Hmm.
I think we also have to point out that most of the Black Lives Matter protests that we saw last summer, they were peaceful.
There were riots, there was looting,
but the vast majority of them were peaceful. So I guess the question is, are the bills that we're talking about, are they actually solving a legitimate problem?
I think that is really the ultimate question. And it begs to me the question of why legislators are really doing this. 93% of the protests were peaceful. And the violence that did occur last summer during the several months of protest, actually over 80% of those attacks were on by the part of government, which means that journalists, activists, other protesters were not predominantly causing violence. And so these bills are solving a problem that doesn't exist. All of that then kind of fanned by January 6th, in which legislators say, see, we have a problem. And I think that is conflating two very different issues and situations.
Nora Benavides is a civil rights lawyer and director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at the nonprofit PEN America. Nora, thanks for coming back and speaking with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.